And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Keith Law, and welcome to episode 550 of The Keith Law Show. I am going to have a great long conversation today with my friend Tim Grierson, film critic for Screen International and author of the brand new book, This Is How You Make a Movie, which came out on March 9th. We're going to talk about his book. We're going to talk about the Oscar nominations, which came out this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about the Cardinals, of whom he is a fan. First, would just like to mention, I did have a piece go up last week for subscribers to The Athletic, listing prospects I can't wait to go see once the minor league season resumes, which right now is supposed to start on May 4th. I will have a column up later this week looking at some potential breakout players for the major league season for the 2021 season. I'm still looking at candidates for that. If you hear this and you want to ask about somebody, you're wondering if I'm going to include somebody, send me a tweet. I'm Keith Law on Twitter, and I will at least consider it, even if it's somebody I don't think is worth a breakout pick. It gives me fodder maybe to answer somewhere in a later piece or in a chat. Finally, my book, The Inside Game, Bad Calls, Strange Moves, and What Baseball Behavior Teaches Us About Ourselves, will come out in paperback in just 3 weeks on April 6th, 3 weeks from Tuesday. You can pre-order it now at Bookshop, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or through your local independent bookstore. I'm sure they would appreciate your business during this difficult time for them. March Madness is here, and starting on Tuesday, March 16th, The Athletic's college basketball crew brings you The Ding U, presented by BetMGM. They'll cover all of the action, both on the court and at the sportsbook, grabbing insight from The Athletic's college basketball writers and picking the brains of BetMGM's top bookmakers. Check out the show on the Daily Ding podcast feed and streaming on YouTube. The debut episode of Ding U streams at 1 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday. Now it is my great pleasure to be joined by my friend Tim Grierson. Tim is a film critic for Screen International. He also writes for Pace. He writes for Vulture. He is the co-host of the Grierson and Leach movie podcast, which is one of the very few podcasts I actually listen to on a regular basis. He also has a new book out called, very modestly titled, This Is How You Make a Movie. I've just finished it. I've actually now made three movies since reading this book because I know exactly how one makes a movie. It came out on March 9th from Hachette and Lawrence King Publishing. You can buy it at all the bookstore places. So, Tim, congratulations and thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much and thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So the book is it's very different. When you mentioned to me that the book was coming out and asked if you could have them send me a copy. Of course, I said yes, but I didn't know really what it was going to entail. And I find it really interesting. You seem to have – it's almost like you had an outline of different techniques, tricks, not in the gimmicky sense, although a few of these could be gimmicky, I guess. And it's with each one, you make sure to explain it, depict it through usually three examples from different films, often that go in very different directions. I mean, is that generally what you were trying to do? Because you do cover a lot of ground in less than 200 pages here.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of an evolution in terms of how the book started. The conversation started about 3 years ago when my editor asked me about making a book that laid out the principles of how do people actually make movies? Like, whether you're an actor or a writer or a director or an editor, how does that actually work? And so I had that conversation with my editor. I was driving around and I was just starting to think like, okay, so what would be in that type of book? And then I sat down and I wrote down every teaching point I could think of. And I just wrote them all down. I didn't know what movies they were going to be. And I just put them down one by one by one. And then I started to group them by different sort of disciplines. And then once I started to lay it out, I'm like, okay, so this could actually work. And what would be fun about it is if we use three examples from movies, but try to make them as different of examples as possible, whether it's by country, by time period, by genre, to really kind of give an audience the sense of there are, I mean, to your point about the title, Keith, it's like my hope was that the title would grab people, but then, and I mentioned this in the introduction, but I wanted people to very quickly understand that there actually is no one right way to make a movie, and that the book will actually give people a launching pad to go, oh, I could do this, or I could do it this way, or it can work this way. And actually, rather than being really kind of narrow, that actually would sort of expand people's idea of all the different kind of ways that movies have been made over the years, and also how the different sort of things I talk about in the book, how those different styles and techniques have evolved over time to show that there's not just one way, even in these different examples, how you actually make a movie. So it was sort of a trial and error process, figuring out the ideas, what was going to be in the book. And then once I had that, I just started writing, and then figuring out the movies was really fun. And then actually sort of like seeing the book all laid out, it's like, wow, this isn't everything. This isn't every example of how to make a movie, but this is sort of a good starter guide for a lot of people.
Yeah, you cover literally 100 years of movies. Intolerance, I think, is the oldest movie that you mentioned in the books. That's 1915, I think. There are movies just from a couple of years ago. Dunkirk, in your crosscut, your description of crosscutting. And what I particularly appreciated was, if you describe this to me, I say, is this going to be a bunch of like Godard and Bertolini and a bunch of movies I've never seen any of those movies. But as it turns out, you do go through genres. There's quite a bit of Star Wars in here, which, let's face it, I appreciate. I've seen a lot of those. You have I'm just looking through the index to make sure. You have Paranormal Activity 3, which is the one where they put the camera on the rotating fan, the oscillating fan.
Right.
As, hey, look, that's a – you could argue it's a – gimmick, it's a technique, whatever it is a very good example for you to describe one of your particular techniques without resorting to films that people haven't seen. I would say probably, I don't know exactly how many films, there's got to be, I don't know, 150 or so in here. People will have seen at least half of them. If you're at all a film goer or a film fan, you've probably seen at least half of them. There are very few in here that I looked at and said, I've actually never heard of this movie. And nearly all of those were not made in English.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting in terms of the process of figuring that out, because I wanted it to be accessible to people. But the challenge is like, so who's the audience? You know, is it someone like you, Keith, who's into movies, but maybe doesn't have like a knowledge of all different types of like international cinema? Or is it like a young person who's like starting out, who's maybe 17 years old and just getting into movies? And I basically decided that the answer was that the audience was kind of everybody. And I wasn't going to worry about, I mean, the way you described it, actually, I kind of love, because that's actually what I hoped, which would be like, oh, I know two of the examples of the three that Tim's talking about. I don't know the third one, but the other two I know. And so I feel like I'm in safe hands with Tim kind of walking me through this technique. And now the third movie that I don't know, I'm actually really kind of curious about it, because my hope was that with each of the descriptions and how I kind of walk people through this stuff, it would give you a sense of what those movies are, but also it would make it feel not so scary or esoteric. It wouldn't feel too highfalutin, though I have Godard in there, though I do have like, you know, Antonioni in there. It's like I do have some of those guys that, you know, might art house auteurs that might scare off some people. But my hope is that like there's Star Wars in there, Avengers is in there, Paranormal Activity 3, which is the best of the Paranormal Activity series, is in there, because I love that technique. And when I was doing that about like moving the camera, I thought, well, that's an idea that people would not immediately think of. But if you've seen that movie, and a lot of people did, you're like, oh, that's a really kind of user-friendly way of explaining how that technique works. And so deciding like that balance of films I knew people would know, and then movies I was like, you know what, take a chance with me on this movie. Like, let me explain this. I think you'll kind of appreciate it and get it. Like, Rocky is in the book. I definitely mentioned Rocky in there. But there's other ones like, maybe people haven't seen The Lobster, you know, maybe people haven't seen even like 2001 or Intolerance or whatever. And so that for me was kind of part of the fun. And I hope it's fun for readers as well, is that kind of like I jump around a lot. I do a lot of different genres. I do a lot of different types of movies. I do a lot of different types of eras. And so I'm really glad to hear that you say that, Keith, because that was kind of part of the mission for the book from the very beginning.
One other thing I thought was, well, many things I thought were interesting in This Is How You Make a Movie, but one thing was, it seems like at multiple points you're actually discussing movies that I get the sense you don't think the movie is necessarily that good, but the technique was worth discussing. So I just flipped through to make sure I had the right one. It was, so in your description of split screen, of showing using split screen, you have Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which I have not seen, but I think most people have at least heard of. I had heard of it. Down with Love, which I actually low-key really like, because once you appreciate it, you realize it's a parody of those Doris Day, Rex Hudson films. You realize it's actually kind of hilarious. And it's definitely one of those, like, when people – you, that's one of those movies, too. If you find someone else who saw it, there's that we're in the club, right?
Right.
You know, yes. That movie. And then the third movie is Time Code, which I had never heard of, despite the fact that these are all pretty famous actors. And my – you even say Figgis's ploy of using a split screen, this still image you have here actually has four boxes. It's split into quadrants. Figgis's ploy may have been little more than a gimmick. Timecode didn't inspire many to follow its example, but it remains a fascinating exercise. And to me, that's maybe the most interesting part, is we don't often see explanations of techniques like that in, maybe, hey, maybe they tried it and it didn't really work, or this was a good technique in a kind of otherwise mediocre film.
Yeah, it's interesting, because Time Code was a movie that Mike Figgis made. It maybe was right after, or maybe a movie after, Leaving Las Vegas. And so, like, he had a little bit of cachet, and so he made this experiment. I actually like Time Code quite a lot, but it's interesting because it's a movie that kind of tried to do something, and nobody followed in its footsteps. Yeah. Nobody ever tried to do anything after that. And there are other examples in the book that do speak to your point, though, specifically, which is that I don't think the movie is that great, but the technique is worthwhile. And I would say that in general, in terms of the movies that I picked, the movies, if you look through the, if you like thumb through the pages, I am not saying that these movies are the canon. These are the great films of all time that everybody needs to see. But even a mediocre film can have a really interesting technique. And I would actually argue that sometimes a mediocre movie with a really cool idea is kind of great, because then another filmmaker can look at that and be like, oh, I should borrow this technique. I can use this and do something better with it. Like, this is a different kind of thing, but my argument for like how you remake a movie is, take a movie that had a great idea, but just wasn't very good, like the original Ocean's 11, remake that movie, because then you can actually do a good movie, because the idea is good, but not a lot of people will say, how dare you take a Frank Sinatra movie and remake it? And in some ways, that's kind of like with some of the things that some of the movies that are in the book are kind of that way as well. I mean, down with the Rock Hudson parody, kind of the
Rock Hudson, yes.
Yeah.
But Down With Love.
Yeah, Down With Love, which I always get confused with the Jim Jarmusch film. But anyway, but Down With Love is actually a movie I don't love super much, interestingly enough. But that technique is so clever in that film. It's so well done, to your point, because if you know what the technique is that they're satirizing, you laugh along with it. And so of those three examples, Down With Love is actually the one that's more that way for me, in terms of something where it's like, well, it doesn't necessarily, the movie's maybe not necessarily great, but this technique is something that everybody needs to know about.
I loved also, so my daughter was here today, she's on spring break, and she saw me reading this. She said, why are you, you know, what is that book? I said, oh, actually, I'm interviewing the author today on my podcast. And I opened up to Forced Perspective, where the first example you give is Elf.
Yes.
I don't think most people would look at Elf and say that's an example of you know, great artistry, except there's the it is the scene where we see Buddy in a classroom with the other elves, and of course he's twice their size at least. And it's funny, I remembered the scene and just immediately, so I was like, well, it's digital, right? They just did that in CG afterwards, but it's not. It is a great example of forced perspective, and I love the fact that it's a film that probably is as widely seen as anything you're describing in this book, because of its recency and because it's on incessantly during the holidays, yes. Obviously. But hey, it turns out that wasn't CG. That was actually just playing with the eye and a great introduction to Trompe L'Oeil, which you then describe more in the next page in a movie I'd never heard of, Songs from the Second Floor. Still need to Google that and learn something about it. And then King Kong. Like that, to me, that is such a great transition too. And so I could show her, she hasn't seen the second two. If she had seen Songs from the Second Floor, that would have really surprised me. But she knows Elf. And I flipped through and showed her a few of these and showed her that still shot, which she knows, and said, hey, are you curious how this is done? And she's in an age now too where, yeah, she's just generally pretty curious and was fascinated to know. I said, oh, actually, those actors are further away from the camera. You just don't realize it. And she was interested enough that we flipped through and went through a couple more examples to show her, hey, here's how some of these things are done, to the point where she's like, can I borrow the book, because she has to write something on film for her English class, I think. They just watched The Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yeah.
Which I know you really enjoy.
Yes.
But I love the fact that, I mean, here's a sort of pop Christmas movie, but it's a great way to demonstrate this force, to demonstrate the technique of using forced perspective.
Yeah, and Elf is also like a fun example, but like you said, because everybody's seen it. But it's something like, you know, I think in general, comedies and family films don't necessarily get the type of respect in terms of, oh, there's actually technique involved in these types of things. And so Elf just kind of jumped out at me as a really great example of that. Yeah, Roy Anderson is a filmmaker I really like, and I definitely recommend that movie and some other ones that he's done as well. But yeah, it's like that one's another kind of fun. I gave it, you know, a good friend of mine who I've known for a long time, his kids are my god kids, and they're like 8 and 4 or something like that, like in that age range. And they were reading the book and they sent a picture, which was very sweet. And then I said, are there movies for kids, like little kids, like obviously younger than your daughter? And like Star Wars, Avengers, Elf falls into that category. Technically speaking, 2001 A Space Odyssey is rated G, so that would also count as a movie for kids. But I just, you know, I have to give like a real sort of shout out to the art team, the people who designed the book. We always knew it was going to be 3 examples per chapter. It was going, or three examples per lesson, and it was going to have like a still or a series of stills from each movie. But the way that they laid it out, and just like the look of the book, I can't take credit for that other than saying, that looks good. I love that. Please keep doing that. They came up with that. And I think it really, the book is very inviting. The title obviously kind of lures you in. But I think in a lot of ways, just the layout of the book, I had a friend of mine say, like, I just want to watch a bunch of movies now after reading your book. And that's kind of the idea. The idea is like, yes, you'll learn how to make a movie. You'll learn some of these things. But just like, especially in a pandemic year, though I've seen a ton of stuff during the pandemic, like I miss movies as a thing that I share with other people. And though most of this book was written before the pandemic, I've actually been really happy to hear from people where it's like, yay, movies. This book is filled with movies, and I'm very happy about that. And I find that very gratifying because I like writing about this stuff. I like explaining this stuff and kind of digging into it. So that the fact that people are kind of like understanding that and appreciating that, I am super, super thrilled.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a 1-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
It's funny because I've had two things now that are driving me, particularly since I've read the book over the weekend, finished this morning. That made me want to watch a bunch of movies and reminded me there are certain, like, I've actually never seen The Shining. The Shining. But also, so my wife comes downstairs this morning from after doing some call, and she says, oh, so are we just going to watch a bunch of Oscar nominees now from now until, you know, April 20th, whatever, when they're actually doing the ceremony? Because we're, even though we've seen a lot of movies during the pandemic, there were some surprises and some movies that still haven't hit streaming because we're not going to theaters, obviously. But the Oscar nominations came out this morning and suddenly said, okay, we have our homework now. We know we have our list of things we need to try to see. So I know you and Will Leach on your podcast did your various predictions, and it looks like there were quite a few maybe surprises, including in Best Picture, where if I remember correctly, only 8 films got nominated.
That's right, only 8 got nominated. Yeah. In terms of the big surprises of things that everybody thought were going to get nominated, One Night in Miami did not get nominated. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom did not get nominated for Best Picture. Ones that were more surprising, Sound of Metal got in, which I was on my top 10. I like it quite a lot, and so I'm happy that it made the list. And people were not sure if The Father, which was also in my top 10, I like a lot, it did make it. Judas and the Black Messiah also got in there. I mean, the other ones, Minari, Nomadland, Promising Young Woman, and The Trial of the Chicago 7. Those 4, most people felt pretty... And also Mank. Those 5, I think most people knew. Mank, Minari, Nomadland, Promising Young Woman, Trial of Chicago 7. People knew those were going to get in. The other 3, those were not for sure. And the fact that Miami didn't get in and Ma Rainey's didn't get in. Some people thought News of the World might get in. That did not make it in either. Those were surprises, I have to say. And you know, there's always this question of optics and how things look, and are things snubbed? And snub for me is always kind of a weird thing, because I'm part of 2 critics organizations and we vote for annual awards. And it's always funny to be in those rooms before this year, we were actually in the same rooms together voting on these awards. Because after you're done, you read all this commentary in the outside world, and people assign all of these meanings to what you did. Like, oh, they were sending a message by nominating this or awarding this or not awarding this. And the truth is, we're just a bunch of random people with opinions of our own, and we don't actually have a conversation about, like, what's the message we want to send? You know, right. It's sort of the same thing with, like, obviously, like, you know, the Baseball Hall of Fame. Like, what's the message they're sending when this person doesn't get in? It's like, no, each individual person is just voting. And there's going to be a lot of conversation about One Night in Miami and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom not getting in, especially in a year of Black Lives Matter. Now, those movies got acting nominations, but the fact that neither of them got nominated for Best Picture, and the fact that the awards are not for another, like, 6 weeks, there's going to be a lot of conversation about that. You're going to be hearing a lot about why were they overlooked, why were they not part of the conversation in terms of Best Picture. On the other hand, though, I have to say there's a lot of things I was really happy about. I was really happy that Paul Raci got nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Sound of Metal. That's on Amazon. Riz Ahmed also got nominated. That was a little bit more expected. And a movie I've been sort of banging the drum for about a year called Collective, this Romanian documentary, was nominated for both Best Documentary and Best International Film. It's this terrific, like, piece of journalism about corruption in the Romanian healthcare system that feels like All the President's Men mixed with this really, like, fascinating, like, procedural about how government works or doesn't work. That got 2 nominations. I've been talking about it all year long. I was really happy to see it get both nominations.
Yeah, that's been on my 2 watch list for a while. Because you recommended it, because you and Will have both recommended it so highly. One of the things that jumped out at me you know, I'm glad you mentioned the One Night in Miami being perhaps snubbed or simply not included in more categories. Regina King did not get a Best Director nomination. Here we did have two women nominated for Best Director, but she was not one of them. In fact, one of the nominations went to the director of Another Round, a Danish language film that got one of the five nominations for Best International Feature Film. Who knows what goes through the minds of the people making these nominations. But one thing I wondered, I liked One Night in Miami. I thought the performances were really good. I do have a bit of a hard time with plays on the screen. And I know The Father is also one of those. I have not seen that yet. But that sometimes they're, it's a tough translation. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was also one. So two of the three major movies that were plays translated to the big screen did not get Best Picture nominations. Do you think there's anything to that, that maybe that doesn't play as well perhaps with part of the electorate, because it still feels a bit, even if it's good, it can still feel a bit too much like, no, we just filmed a play and then put it up on a movie screen.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely feels like a takeaway from today, that those two movies are based on plays, and they don't hide the fact, I would argue, that they're plays, that they're based on plays. There's a claustrophobic feel to both of them. Mm-hmm. I would argue that One Night in Miami opens it up more, and I think more effectively opens it up. And The Father is an interesting case because most people like you have not had a chance to see it because it's not streaming anywhere. It will start streaming in a few weeks, mm-hmm. but it's only in theaters, and you know, like most of us, you're not going to theaters right now, which I think is wise. the Father... of the three, The Father is the one I like the most. Mm-hmm. And I think it utilizes its playness the best of the three of them. And I don't want to give away much about what it's about, but I think the film utilizes the fact that it's a play in a really effective way. It's hard to, what's interesting to me is that for people who don't know, when the nominations come out, the way it works is that if you were a director, you would nominate Best Picture, but you would also nominate for Best Director. You wouldn't deal with the acting categories right now because the actors deal with that branch, and likewise the cinematographer does that branch, but everybody's in on Best Picture nominations, and the numbers are not hard and fast, but the Academy is primarily actors. That is the largest branch by far in the Academy. What I'm confused about with Ma Rainey and One Night in Miami is that, yes, they're based on plays, but they're really actorly. And I don't mean that as a derogatory thing, but they're about performances. They're about how good the actors are in it. The fact that neither of those movies got nominated for Best Picture is surprising to me, because you would think actors would respond to a movie that's based on a play, because especially in theater, it's all about performance. It's all about that. And the fact that both movies got acting nominations speaks to the fact that the actors did in fact like the performances in the movie. I have to admit, I'm a little baffled, and I'm not ready to say anything like, oh, well, the Academy's racist or anything like that. I am just, if you had told me there are two big surprises of movies that everybody thinks are going to get nominated that aren't, I probably wouldn't have picked those two. They both felt kind of like locks to me. And listen, Chadwick Boseman is going to win for Best Actor. He is going to win. That in terms of the categories, I think most people assume that. So it's not like people aren't aware of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. It's not like people didn't see it. But I am surprised that both of them missed the cut for Best Picture.
Especially with Judas and the Black Messiah making it. So, I mean, perhaps it's a little unfair to group those three movies together, but we there's at least some thematic connections among them. They actually weirdly have a thematic connection also to Trial of the Chicago 7, which seems to have sailed through everything because Aaron Sorkin, I guess. Whereas I know you would rank Judas and the Black Messiah, I think, lower than both One Night in Miami and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I don't know I actually have your rankings in a spreadsheet, by the way, your top 25, because that also informs our movie watching, but you weren't that high on Judas and the Black Messiah.
First of all, that's very sweet of you to have a chart of my stuff. I appreciate that. Of those three, Judas is the one I think is the least effective, mm-hmm. but it's the most recent. It's the one that has come out the most recent. And what's weird about, you know, in a normal year, not with a pandemic, the conversation is always, is a movie too old? Do people forget? And when they say old, they mean like it comes out in September or October. And like, oh,
Dunkirk.
Yeah, I mean, Dunkirk came out in the summer. That was a concern. It's like, and this year's been so totally different. But that recency bias, which you know very well, Keith, is like a thing where I do think it does affect awards season. And it's actually funny. I have to tell you that one of the things I loved about your book is like so much of that does actually apply to Oscar season in terms of faulty thinking. And recency bias is one of them where I think people go, well, we just saw Judas and the Black Messiah. That's a little more prominent in our mind. And it's, again, like you said, you don't want to think that the Academy said, well, we only want to award one Black-centric movie. Which one do we see more recently? But when you see how it has played out today, it is hard to give the Academy the benefit of the doubt when you look at that. Though I am still surprised. I think Judas and the Black Messiah has two very good performances, and they've both been nominated, Lakeith Stanfield and Daniel Kaluuya. But as a movie, I don't think it's nearly as strong. Honestly, of the Best Picture nominees, I think it's actually one of the weaker. I mean, what's good is that there are no Best Picture nominees. I'm looking at them right now. None of them, I think, are bad movies.
There's no Green Book.
There's no Green Book. There's no Hillbilly Elegy.
Right.
There are movies I think that are okay, that are mediocre, but still strong enough where it's not an embarrassment. All eight of those are good. All those are movies I would say, yes, go see those movies. Obviously, I'm higher on some of them. Nomadland, which I know you also love, is my favorite movie of last year. I am rooting for that. But yeah, I think in Judas and the Black Messiah, apparently it was on HBO Max, but now it's not on HBO Max. So people who want, I didn't confirm that. So I imagine a lot of people want to find that movie now and maybe like, wait, is that not available right now? So maybe the folks at Warner Brothers will change their mind about that, especially because it got so many nominations. In terms of just other like things I was sort of happy about or sort of surprised about, I was really happy Maria Bakalova got nominated for the Borat sequel. That was not a for sure thing. She got a lot of love from critics groups, including critics groups I'm a part of. But that's a comedy performance, and you do not know. Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids is sort of an exception, or like Kevin Kline.
Yeah, that's the one I always think of, Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, I mean, that is like the great unicorn of like, but like, even with Kevin Kline, it's like, well, Kevin Kline's such a great actor that he does something funny. It just shows what a great serious actor he is. People did not know who this woman was before Borat. I think that's part of the reason why she works so well in that movie and is so great. But that was a very pleasant surprise to wake up this morning and see her be nominated. So I'm happy about that. I'm happy about the collective nominations. Time, which got nominated for Best Documentary, I'm very happy about that. Streaming through Amazon, that's a really good movie. If people haven't seen that, I think that they'll really get a lot out of that movie. I think that might actually win for Best Documentary. But on the whole, I'm actually pretty happy with the nominations. Always things you could say, like First Cow, I knew wasn't going to get nominated. I knew it wasn't going to get nominated. It's a movie I love, but it was not on the cards for Kelly Reichardt. It just wasn't going to happen. But for the most part, I think the Academy did a pretty decent job this morning.
The one other sort of random, I mean, it just looks random because it's a bit of an outlier, but The White Tiger got an adapted screenplay nomination. I liked that movie and I liked the book. I had read the book a long time ago, I think not long after it won the Booker Prize. And the movie was pretty faithful, actually. And there's definitely some little issues in it. Priyanka Chopra was not great in it. I'm not a huge fan of her as an actress, but I thought the story was really good. I thought the relative newcomer who played the lead role was excellent. I thought I can see why if they were going to give it any nomination for it to get one for the script, because the movie really just moved extremely well and took a book that was pretty rich and translated to the screen without having to make a whole lot of changes. And I'm not sure, who knows why certain things get nominations. But that was its one. It's a standout. It just jumps out because it's the one thing it showed up. It's the one, I think, of all 10 screenplay nominees that was probably the least seen and the least, there are no other nominations, not a lot of other critical acclaim or awards acclaim for it elsewhere, but it did sneak in there, which I was just happy to see because I think it's actually pretty good. And it's on Netflix, so anybody can watch it.
Yeah, and it's, to your point, it was very under the radar. Mm-hmm. The reviews were good, but it wasn't something where, I mean, Netflix has a lot of movies that they were pushing. White Tiger wasn't necessarily one that you heard a lot about. You know, Mank, you heard a lot about, Trial of the Chicago 7, you heard a lot about. Even Defy Bloods, just speaking as a critic, there was more stuff that was sent to me by Netflix for Defy Bloods than White Tiger. And now is the part where I confess that, Keith, I haven't seen White Tiger yet. When I saw your review, I was like, it's one of those moments where I'm like, I hope Keith doesn't like it so I can feel okay about not having seen it yet. And when I saw yours and other people have been talking about it, it's a nice story of a movie that has just kind of found, maybe not necessarily an audience because Netflix doesn't put out like actual viewer numbers, but the Academy, like at least the writing branch, they found it. And they champion it. And that's been kind of a nice thing. So, you know, even as somebody who sees as much stuff as I do, there's stuff that I miss. White Tiger is one of those movies. The documentary section, The Mole Agent, I have missed multiple times. My beloved mother has seen that movie at True False, the documentary festival that I love so much. She has seen that movie. I have yet to see it, but I've heard nothing but good things about it. Same thing with The Octopus, or My Octopus Teacher in the documentary section. There were several of my colleagues who were sure that that was a joke that someone had put on Wikipedia, but no, that is an actual documentary. I haven't seen that
people
one
love
yet.
That thing. People yeah, have people, seen it, love it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where that category is always so weird because documentaries always divide into very serious, meaningful movies about important subjects, like, say, Time, the Garrett Bradley film. Mm-hmm. And then some of the stuff that's a little more upbeat, like Crip Camp, which I also like quite a lot, but that's more of an inspirational kind of story. It's always kind of weird to see what does the Academy go for, the more inspirational thing or something that's maybe a little more hard-hitting, and it kind of goes back and forth between years. But I'm actually glad that you mentioned White Tiger, because I was making my list this morning of have to catch up with this now. And I saw White Tiger. I'm like, I knew I was going to talk to you today. I'm like, Keith likes that movie. I will now finally get around to seeing that. And so even for me as a film critic, today is kind of fun because it's like, oh, there's other stuff I have to catch up on now.
Yes, the documentary and the international, they fascinate me, best international feature, because each has its own different unique process where movies get funneled into that, where, you know, Netflix, I think, was pushing a Sun a bit for, and it made the shortlist, but didn't make the international, the final five nominees for that, for best international feature. And then the best documentary I think I've seen from last year so far, I haven't seen Collective, was Transhood, which is on HBO. I don't have any idea if that got any consideration at all. I just know it didn't get a nomination, and then that's it. It's kind of opaque how films end up getting through to that final stage.
Yeah, and the rules changed this year because normally it's like you have to have, for those categories, a qualifying run in New York and Los Angeles for a week. And so a documentary will just drop into a theater for a week in Los Angeles. No advertisement, but that just sort of qualifies it. This year, because of the pandemic, the Academy relax those rules. And so of all years, that documentary would have had a better chance. Transhood is something else I have still not seen, though I know that you are a fan because I've seen you talk about it. And it is always a thing where a lot of people this year, because, you know, the podcast that Will Leach and I do, we've been reviewing new movies as they come out, but often people will say, but I can't see this. How can I see this? And I understand people's frustration, especially when we say something like, Nomadland is a great movie, you should see it. And that was in December, and it only became available on Hulu in February. The nice thing, I think, for a lot of people who are interested in the Academy Awards, when you see the nominations this year, I would recommend not saying, I haven't heard of any of these, though I understand that that might be the feeling because it's been such a weird year. What I would rather say is like, oh, this is a great guide of catching up. These aren't the best movies of last year, but there's a lot of good movies on this list. There's a lot of things worth kind of like catching up on, checking out. Nomadland, obviously, Minari is definitely on that list. And even like Trial of the Chicago 7, it's like, that's a perfectly solid movie. We're like 6 weeks away from the Oscars. I am not convinced that that movie is not going to win Best Picture. There's a lot of reasons why Trial of the Chicago 7 is an Oscar-winning looking movie. And that movie is not great, but it's solid and it works. It's worth, you know, it's worth like seeing, and then seeing Mangrove, the Steve McQueen movie that's part of the Small Axe series. It's like a better version of the same kind of like trial, like a courtroom drama kind of thing. But this is a good list. This movie has Sound of Metal on it. You're a big fan of Wolfwalkers. Wolfwalkers is on this list, Keith. It's like The Father is great. There's a lot of really good stuff on this list. I mean, Onward is also on the list, which isn't that Pixar movie that I did not like very much
at
all.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, for Shaun the Sheep fans, for people who like Aardman, like that's on the animated list.
So I'm one of them. I do enjoy. I haven't seen this one, but I enjoy Shaun the Sheep.
Yeah, I haven't seen this one either. But I mean, it's like if you are in the wheelhouse of the Shaun the Sheep cinematic universe, you will probably like this movie, I think. So there's a lot of things on this list I'm pretty happy with today.
So this is ostensibly a baseball podcast, though really it's my podcast. I can talk about whatever I want. But you are a baseball fan. You are a fan of a team that plays somewhere in the middle of the country, one of those flyover teams, I think.
Right, yes.
But I feel like they just got a third baseman kind of for free in the trade market. And I imagine you're fairly happy about that.
I am happy about Nolan Arenado for the Cardinals, right? That's who you're talking about.
Yes, yeah, that's what they're called. I forgot.
Yeah, yes, I am happy about that. I feel like whenever I'm on any type of thing, I'm supposed to apologize for being a Cardinal fan. And I'm a Cardinal fan, and I'm a self-conscious Cardinal fan, and I was raised Catholic. So I have Catholic guilt and Cardinal guilt going on in my life. So I do apologize. I understand. I get it. It also kind of annoys me, the whole Cardinal way. So I get it. I am really excited and hopeful. But, you know, it's the National League Central is such a weird division where it's like, well, we're kind of trying, but, you know, not really trying. And it's frustrating. Like, I live in Los Angeles and I've lived here for 25 years, something like that. And so for me, the Cardinals have been a road team. Like they've been like a team that I only can kind of follow from a distance because I don't subscribe to like being able to watch all their games because I just like timing wise doesn't work for me normally. And so I have followed them from afar for a very long time now. And so sometimes it feels like I get these communiques in a bottle where it's like, you know, we got Nolan Arenado. Like what happened? And I am happy that they have him. I'm happy that they have Goldschmidt. I don't know if they have enough pitching. I don't know if they have decided yet, like, who is probably going to be their closer and if that person, in fact, is going to end up being their closer the entire year. I am waiting for Yadi, who I love, to break down. And the Cardinals having to make the decision of we have to not play him as much and how the Cardinal fan base is going to handle that. I am the glass half empty person when it comes to my Cardinal fandom, as you can probably tell from this.
Yes.
Like Adam Wainwright is a guy that I will have endless happy memories about. And I owe him much of my like mental health on him doing the things he's done over the last 15 years. He had a great season last year. Who knows? And if he goes down, who are they going to replace him with? Matt Carpenter, that salsa apparently has stopped working. So it's like, and I bought a lot of it and it's not working for me either anymore. So
I've seen your swing. Yeah, it's just not going to work.
It's nothing but holes, Keith. Yes. That's the problem. It's nothing but holes. For me, what I like going into a season is I like not being the front runner, even in the National League Central. I mean, it's kind of
where everyone's like running backwards.
Yeah, everybody's running backwards, and like every metric, we're kind of in the middle. And I kind of like that because I always preferred those seasons to the Cardinals are going to win 100 games. It's just a question of how many are they going to win and can they win the World Series this year? There is just a part of me that always likes more of a sense of having to prove something as opposed to it just being kind of handed to you and then being told, well, you didn't win 100 games. What happens? And like in some ways, I will always love the 2006 season because that was such they kind of stumbled. They had so many injuries. They had so many problems. And then they just kind of like, and by the way, I realize by saying I love the 2006 season, I once again have to apologize because I know everybody else hates that World Series and hates that playoff. And so I apologize. But that to me is like, you know, I hope it will not offend you to say, especially you, the scrappiness of a team, which is not a thing that you can measure, is something that sometimes I do enjoy. Now, it's more that, but this thing that is there is a satisfying quality in that that I do kind of enjoy. You know, I don't want to get like all Patriots fanny and being like, no one gave us a chance this year. But I tend to like.
Did you count out touchdown, Tom?
Hang on a second. Let me think. Keith, I did not. Okay. I did not. How can you count him out for crying out loud? A touchdown, Tom. He's so handsome. Anyway, so this year I'm going in. I'm really happy. Obviously, we have Arenado, but I also like that everybody's like Dodgers and Padres. Everybody's looking at Dodgers and Padres. And listen, I live out here. I'm also really excited about Dodgers and Padres and seeing how that's going to play out. I kind of like that we are under the radar and that nobody is really going to pay attention to us. Even though we have Arenado, the Cardinals start to kind of like disappear, I feel like, during like the national conversation, unless they're really good. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like people pay attention to the Mets. Are they going to implode? They'll pay attention to the Padres and the Dodgers in the National League. And we'll just see how we're going to do. So Doc, that's how I'm feeling right now about the Cardinals.
Well, we'll have to see what Dylan Carlson can do to solve the outfield problem. And I'm not sure about the pitching. I agree with you. I actually still think I'm going to pick them to win the Central because, like I said, most of the other teams seem to try to just go. Nobody's really actively tried to get better until the Brewers suddenly jumped in with a couple of late moves, like signing Right. Colton Wong and signing Jackie Bradley Jr., which turned out to be prescient because Kane got hurt. So. Yeah, but before that, I think I joked at the time of the Arenado trade, the Cardinals were the only team that seemed to be actively trying to win that division. But I agree with you. I also think that we're not going to discuss them with the Dodgers and Padres. On paper, they're not as good as those teams. I think they're not as good as Atlanta on paper. But yeah. The way that the divisions are structured, too, someone wins the division. Someone's getting to the postseason. And if I were to bet on someone, it's the Cardinals. Then at that point, who knows? Like, we've absolutely seen teams just get into the postseason. 2006 Cardinals are a good example. And then suddenly it is an entire, we start over and it no longer matters who was the preseason favorite. No longer matters so much who was better on paper once you've got short series.
Yeah. And also like just the fact that we're going to have a quote unquote normal year this mm-hmm. year in terms of the length of it. I am not somebody who's like, well, last season doesn't count because it was a weirder like sample size, but this will have more of the feel of a traditional season. And I'm curious, like Yelich could very easily realize like, oh wait, I'm really good. I should be good again. And that changes the division entirely. You know, like in some ways the best signing the Brewers did was simply like waking up Yelich and being like, oh yeah, you could be good again. And he might be. Right. So it's only March and I'm just kind of like, baseball stadiums are opening up again. I'm not ready to go to a stadium again soon, but just the idea of there being between the basketball tournament coming back, the college basketball tournament coming back, and the idea of like a more traditional baseball season, those are the signs of like, okay, life is, fingers crossed, slowly coming back. And that feels very nice. And it feels like I kind of missed baseball last year. We had baseball last year, but to me, like not having it in the spring and the early summer, I miss that as part of a tradition, like a ritual in my life. And so I'm excited to kind of like get back into the swing of paying attention to baseball and watching baseball and being frustrated by baseball at the same time. I'm excited to have that back in my life.
I am too. I cannot wait. My guest today has been Tim Grierson. He is the author of the new book, This Is How You Make a Movie, which you can buy on Bookshop, Amazon, anywhere you buy your books. I highly recommend it if you're interested in movies at all or wonder what some of these terms mean, what it means to what chiaroscuro means, what I can't even, was it non-diegetic sounds?
Yeah, you got it, yes.
Oh, excellent. I've never seen that word before in my life.
Keith, don't spoil it. I'm trying to sell some books here.
That's
don't tell people what non-diegetic sound is. They have to buy the book to find out.
Yes, they absolutely should. That and canted ang, I'm flipping through this. There were a lot of things I did not know, and I like to pretend I know everything, but it turns out I knew very little about movies. So this book was great. Tim, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you so much for joining me. Please stay safe, and if you can, go get that vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.